From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. U.S. grand jury decides not to indict Ferguson, Missouri police officer. Iran nuclear talks extended through June. U.S. Defense Secretary Hagel resigns. These stories and more coming up. I'm Ray Kugel. A grand jury in the Midwestern U.S. state of Missouri decided not to indict a white police officer who shot and killed a black teenager during a street confrontation almost 4 months ago. The panel considered charges against Darren Wilson, the suburban St. Louis officer who fatally shot 18-year-old Michael Brown on August 9th. St. Louis County Prosecutor Robert McCulloch made the announcement Monday night.
The duty of the grand jury is to separate fact from fiction. After a full and impartial and critical examination of all the evidence in the law and decide if that evidence supported the filing of any criminal charges against Darren Wilson, they accepted and completed this monumental responsibility in a conscientious and expeditious manner. It is important to note here and say again that they are the only people who have heard and examined every witness and every piece of evidence. They discussed and debated the evidence among themselves before arriving at their collective decision. After their exhaustive review of the evidence, the grand jury deliberated over 2 days, making their final decision. They determined that no probable cause exists to file any charge against Officer Wilson and returned a no true bill on each of the 5 indictments.
Michael Brown's family expressed profound disappointment with the ruling. It is said Brown was trying to surrender to the officer. Others say the policeman acted in self-defense. Tear gas at this hour is being used to disperse the crowds. President Obama, within the past few minutes, called for calm. The shooting last August inflamed tensions in the predominantly black St. Louis suburb that is patrolled by an overwhelmingly white police force. Violent protests at that time lasted for weeks. International powers and Iran have extended talks into next year on a comprehensive nuclear deal after failing Monday to seal an agreement ending the standoff over Tehran's nuclear ambitions. VOA's Al Pessin reports.
More than a year of intensive talks and the direct involvement of 7 foreign ministers for the last several days failed to settle the differences over how much nuclear enrichment capability Iran will be allowed to have and how quickly economic sanctions will be lifted. The goal is to ensure Iran cannot quickly produce a nuclear weapon if its leaders decide to do so and to have inspectors in place to detect any such move. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said real progress was made during the last several days of talks, and officials have a better idea what a final agreement will look like. But he indicated he has no illusions about the work ahead.
These talks aren't going to suddenly get easier just because we extend them. They're tough, and they've been tough, and they're going to stay tough.
Kerry also called for support for the extension of the talks in the face of expected criticism from hardliners in Iran and the United States.
We would be fools to walk away from a situation where the breakout time has already been expanded rather than narrowed, and where the world is safer because this program is in place.
Kerry was referring to the time it would take Iran to enrich enough nuclear material to build a bomb, which he said has been expanded by steps Iran took under the interim accord signed a year ago. That agreement was due to expire on Monday, but has now been extended, including limited relief for Iran from economic sanctions. He called on the U.S. Congress to give Iran credit for honoring the agreement and to give negotiators more time to reach a final accord. Negotiators now aim to complete the outlines of an agreement by March, with technical experts working out the details by July 1st. It's a long and, for many, disappointing extension of a process that has already gone on for more than a year. Overall, the international community has been trying to convince Iran to open and curtail its nuclear program for 12 years. But Ali Vaez of the International Crisis Group says the negotiators may be in a better position to reach an agreement in the next phase of the talks.
Their positions have been clarified. Therefore, they can adopt a much more realistic approach towards the negotiations rather than an approach that was based on brinkmanship.
Still, he notes that hardliners in Iran and in the U.S. Congress could try to scuttle any chance of an accord.
Nothing is guaranteed, but they're now closer than ever to an agreement. They've invested heavily in this process, and it's simply too big to fail.
Many experts believe Iran previously had a secret nuclear weapons program, but now its leaders say they have no interest in developing such weapons and only want a nuclear enrichment capability for energy and medicine. But negotiators from the United States, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China, deputized by the UN Security Council, say that program must be considerably smaller than Iran has now, while Iran wants to expand its capacity. The negotiators want Iran to be at least 6 months, preferably a year away from building a nuclear bomb. Under the extension, Iran will maintain the temporary restrictions on its nuclear enrichment program that were agreed on a year ago. The United States will continue its slightly eased sanctions policy, including the release of $700 million of Iranian frozen assets every month. But the wide range of global trade sanctions will remain in force. Al Pessin, VOA News, Vienna.
Iran has insisted its nuclear program is solely for peaceful civilian purposes, such as medical research and generating power. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is leaving his job. He held the post for the past 19 months. President Obama announced Secretary Hagel's resignation Monday. VOA's Victoria Mackey has details.
Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, a former Republican senator and Army veteran, tendered his resignation to President Barack Obama on Monday. At the White House, the president praised Hagel's work, but gave little explanation for the secretary's departure. He said Hagel approached him last month, saying it was the appropriate time to step down as the president enters the last 2 years of his term.
Chuck has been an exemplary defense secretary, providing a steady hand as we modernized our strategy and budget to meet long-term threats while still responding to immediate challenges like ISIL and Ebola.
Hagel, who served in Vietnam before working in the public and private sectors, also made no mention of the reason for his resignation.
It's been the greatest privilege of my life, the greatest privilege of my life to lead and, most important, to serve with the men and women of the Defense Department and support their families. I am immensely proud of what we've accomplished during this time.
The New York Times, citing senior administration officials, reported Hagel's resignation comes under pressure amid several foreign policy crises, including the ongoing battle against the Islamic State militant group in Syria and Iraq. Former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, told VOA he believes the secretary was pushed out after a tenure that began in February 2013.
I don't think he ever made his mark on the department. I think he was there as the errand boy for the White House, which has consistently downplayed the importance of the department.
Mr. Bolton also said the resignation could have been better prepared. He sees the abrupt announcement as an ominous sign.
Whenever you have that kind of disarray, it's a signal that there's more trouble ahead.
Victoria Mackey, VOA News, Washington.
Secretary Hagel will remain in the position until a successor is named. The U.S. Central Command says the U.S. and its allies have conducted 24 airstrikes against Islamic State militants since Friday, launching 9 strikes in Syria and 15 in Iraq. The U.S. military says airstrikes near the Syrian towns of Kobani and Raqqa took out 3 IS fighting positions, targeted several staging areas, and hit one of the group's headquarter buildings. In Iraq, the strikes hit targets near Mosul, Assad, Baghdad, Ramadi, Tal Afar, and Heat, destroying checkpoints in various Islamic State fighter units. Elsewhere, officials say a car bomb exploded in a crowded Shiite-majority area of Baghdad Monday, killing at least 9 people and wounding at least 20. There's been no claim of responsibility. At least 2 NATO soldiers and 6 civilians have been killed in 2 violent attacks across Afghanistan. NATO officials say 2 troops were killed in an attack near a military convoy in Kabul. It did not release the nationality of the soldiers. Later Monday, a bomb strapped to a motorcycle exploded in a market in northern Kunduz province, killing 6 civilians. The international agency Oxfam wants to do something about Afghan women who are consistently excluded from Afghanistan's peace negotiations and formal talks about the country's future. Oxfam is trying to refocus attention on women ahead of an Afghanistan conference in London early next month. Sayla Hennessy reports.
Yorit Kaminga is a policy advisor for Oxfam and has just returned from Kabul. He says Oxfam has tracked 23 known sets of peace talks that have been held between the Taliban, the Afghan government, and the international community in the past 9 years. He says that during talks between the international community and the Taliban, not a single Afghan woman was involved, and women were present only twice during talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. Yorit Kaminga.
Especially for those peace talks organized by the international community, we really didn't see any kind of meaningful participation of women. They may have been consulted at some stage, but really they have not been very active and participating from the start.
An Afghan conference is due to take place in London on December 3rd and 4th, and Oxfam says the international community needs to use the platform to defend women's rights. Under Taliban rule, women in Afghanistan were banned from schools and work. Today, nearly 40% of students are girls. But Oxfam says there's a real risk that these advances will be reversed unless women are kept at the forefront of the agenda.
It's really key that the new government, but also the international community, really commits to what they promised before, saying, you know, women's rights should not be jeopardized and women should really have a seat at the table in any kind of peace negotiations.
Dr. Catherine Brown is an expert on the role of women in situations of war and is based at King's College London. She says it's not unusual for women to play a minor role in peace negotiations. During the past decade, she says, on average, women have represented just 4% of all signatories in global peace deals.
We mustn't think of this as purely a Taliban issue or an Afghanistan issue. This is about conflict resolution worldwide, where women's voices are consistently devalued and excluded.
Brown is not optimistic about the upcoming international conference having a real impact on the lives of women in Afghanistan. But she says such platforms are not necessarily the best way to improve the lives of Afghan women. She says the international community makes an assumption that if you have greater women's participation in the public sphere, then empowerment in the private sphere will follow. Oxfam says women are currently suffering the highest levels of violence seen in Afghanistan. Parliamentary quotas for women are dropping and laws aimed at protecting their rights are under threat. Sayla Hennessy for VOA News, London.
Laboratory tests in India confirm that drugs used during mass sterilizations that killed at least 13 women and made dozens ill at a government-run camp were tainted. The tragedy also raises questions about the practice of conducting mass sterilizations at health camps. Anjana Pasricha explains.
Health Minister of Chhattisgarh State, Amar Agrawal, says the antibiotic Cyprosin, handed out to dozens of women who underwent sterilization surgeries 2 weeks ago, contained zinc phosphide. The chemical is commonly used in rat poison. The women started vomiting and complaining of severe pain after they went home and took the medicine. In the following days, at least 13 died and many fell seriously ill. The drugs had been manufactured by a local drug company in Chhattisgarh and not by one of India's big pharmaceutical companies that export medicines worth billions of dollars. The central Indian state is one of the country's poorest. Indian Pharmaceutical Association's Secretary General, D.G. Shah, says the tragedy underscores the need for much tighter regulation of these small firms, which he warns sometimes do not adhere to GMT or good manufacturing practices.
They supply to one district or at the most one state or 3-4 states. They are not national players. And they are governed by the state drug commissioners. Though on paper they say everybody is complying, but they do not comply. And as has been reported in this case, in spite of poor GMP standards, the state drug commissioner had not taken adequate action for closure of this unit. Now, the only positive side of this incident we see is that it might act as a wake-up call.
The company where the tainted drugs were made had been sanctioned for making substandard drugs in 2012, when it had to suspend production for 3 months. It has now been shuttered and its promoters arrested. There have been allegations that substandard drugs make their way to state government health facilities in exchange for kickbacks. The tragedy has also turned attention to the practice of mass sterilizations carried out at government-run camps, where women are offered a cash incentive of about $10 to undergo tubectomies. In the world's second most populous country of 1.2 billion people, sterilizations continue to be the backbone of population control, although the government denies there is any coercion. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
North Korea is warning of catastrophic consequences for the United States and other countries that supported a recent UN resolution condemning North Korea's human rights record. VOA's Brian Patton reports from Seoul about what such retaliation might really mean.
The rare official announcement released by North Korea's National Defense Commission reads more like a tirade. It refers to U.S. allies like South Korea as riffraffs, a term that means worthless. It calls North Korean defectors human rubbish, and it says the United States and its follower forces, meaning South Korea and Japan, will be unable to escape the heavy blow of merciless punishment. The threats come in response to a recent United Nations committee vote calling on the Security Council to refer North Korea to the International Criminal Court for alleged human rights violations. The Kim Jong-un regime is accused of operating a network of political prisons holding more than 100,000 people and atrocities that include murder, torture, rape, and forced abortions. Kim Young-hyun, a professor of North Korean studies at Dongguk University, says he is not surprised that Pyongyang is reacting with strong language, but not, at least so far, military action. He says he expected that North Korea would express resistance against the international community, including the United States and South Korea, by using rhetoric rather than military action. The North Korean statement denies and rejects the human rights resolution. It describes the UN as the height of shameless burlesque, and it says the resolution is an attack on the country's sovereignty and a declaration of war. The statement refers to the possibility of nuclear conflict, leading some to believe that North Korea is planning another atomic test. It remains unclear if the UN Security Council will refer the North to the International Criminal Court, since Pyongyang's allies, China and Russia, could veto the move. But with the latest North Korean statement, it appears the likelihood of resuming the six-party nuclear talks is remote, some 6 years after the last round in 2008. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
Recent satellite imagery of a Chinese land reclamation project in disputed waters of the South China Sea is drawing new concern from the United States and the Philippines. Simone Orendine has more from Manila.
Chinese land reclamation projects in the South China Sea have been ongoing for years, but this month, new satellite imagery of Fiery Cross Reef appears to show that China's massive construction on the island will eventually mean it could support an airstrip. The Philippines said the construction in an area of the South China Sea that Manila claims as its own raises tensions and is a reminder of the need to pass a long-anticipated code of conduct in the South China Sea. The code is a proposed legal agreement among the 10-member Southeast Asian nations, or ASEAN, and China on how to peacefully handle disputes on competing claims in the South China Sea. Department spokesman Charles Jose says the Chinese construction points to the need for ASEAN to pass guidelines on maintaining the status quo in the disputed region.
Of course, for us, it's something that raises tension in the area. And of course, we would like to de-escalate tension, and we would like to manage tension in the area. And that's the reason why we are working with the ASEAN and China.
Last week, the defense and security analyst publication IHS Jane's Defense Weekly released satellite images taken on November 14th of ongoing reclamation work at Fiery Cross, which is in the heart of the disputed sea. Fiery Cross is known as Yongshu in China and Kagitingan in the Philippines. Apart from the Philippines and China, Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, and Vietnam all have claims in the Spratlys and the wider South China Sea. The sea, which China claims almost entirely, is rich in marine life, potentially huge gas and oil reserves, and is a heavily traveled trade route. The Jane's report says China is building what could be an airstrip and apron on the length of the newly reshaped Fiery Cross. It also says the now 3,000-meter-long and more than 200-meter-wide island appears to have a harbor big enough for military craft. With the release of the report, a U.S. military spokesman called on China to stop reclamation work and instead work toward a diplomatic approach to restraining such activity. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Manila.
A museum in Switzerland will accept hundreds of artworks from the son of a Nazi-era art dealer. German authorities seized a priceless collection of almost 1,300 artworks in 2012 hidden in a Munich apartment. Many of the works were looted from Jewish families across Europe by the Nazis. Henry Ridgewell has details.
The collection of paintings was discovered by tax inspectors who were searching the Munich apartment of Cornelius Gurlitt, son of Adolf Hitler's art dealer Hildebrand Gurlitt, in 2012. Cornelius Gurlitt died in May this year and named the Bern Art Museum in Switzerland as his sole heir. President of the museum's board of trustees, Christoph Schäublin, announced Monday it would accept some of the artworks.
Die Entscheidung, meine Damen und Herren, ist dem Stiftungsrat alles andere als leicht gefallen.
Mr. Schäublin said the decision was far from easy for the board of trustees. He added there were certainly no feelings of triumph, which would be absolutely inappropriate in light of the art collection's history. Among the works are paintings by Pablo Picasso and Pierre-Auguste Renoir. The Bern Art Museum said it would not accept looted artworks and pledged to help return stolen paintings to their rightful owners. That will not be an easy task, says Christopher Marinello of Art Recovery International in London, which specialises in stolen and disputed artworks.
It's extremely difficult to identify and then prove a claim to Nazi-looted artwork. Many of these people were fleeing for their lives, and the last thing they were about to do is grab a box of receipts.
An agreement known as the Washington Principles aims to make it easier for claimants to prove ownership of stolen art. German authorities have struggled to deal with the fallout of the extraordinary find in 2012, says Marinello.
There's a lot to be learned in this case, and the way it was handled for the next time. And I do believe there will be a next time. We have not seen the last of hordes of Nazi-looted works of art.
Earlier this year, a photo album depicting such stolen masterpieces was donated to the United States National Archives. 88-year-old Harry Ettlinger was one. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Russia signed a new treaty with Abkhazia stipulating closer military and economic ties to the breakaway Georgian Republic, which Moscow recognized as an independent state in 2008. The agreement seeks establishment of a joint military command between Russian and Abkhazian forces. Russia's finance minister says the country is losing more than $100 billion a year due to Western sanctions and falling oil prices. The United States and the European Union have imposed several rounds of sanctions against Russia for its role in the conflict in Ukraine. Russia denies involvement in hostilities in eastern Ukraine. That's it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
This is Today in History. On November 25th, 1748, one of the most prolific Christian hymn writers of all time died. Isaac Watts, an English pastor and poet, wrote an estimated 700 songs, including Joy to the World. On this day in 1758, British colonial forces retook Fort Duquesne, located at the strategic junction of the Ohio, the Monongahela, and the Allegheny Rivers in western Pennsylvania. British Virginians began construction, the French captured the fort in 1754, and named it in honor of the Governor General of New France. The French withdrew and burned the fort when British forces advanced. The British then rebuilt and renamed it Fort Pitt in an area that is now the heart of the city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In 1783, nearly 3 months after the signing of the Treaty of Paris ending the American Revolution, the last British soldiers left New York City, the former headquarters of the British Army. On this day in 1835, American industrialist Andrew Carnegie was born. An immigrant from Scotland, he founded the Carnegie Steel Company that later became the U.S. Steel Corporation, at one time the largest steel company in the world. In 1973, Colonel George Papadopoulos, leader of the authoritarian right-wing military junta that overthrew the Greek government in 1967, was himself removed from office in a bloodless coup. He was tried for treason and sentenced to life in prison. On November 25, 1992, the Federal Assembly of Czechoslovakia voted to split the country into the Czech Republic and Slovakia beginning on January 1, 1993. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The international coalition working to bring peace to the Central African Republic met recently in the capital, Bangui, to reaffirm its commitment to helping end the crisis there. Violence has gripped the CAR since December 2012, when the Seleka Armed Group, an alliance of largely Muslim rebels, began a rebellion that overthrew former President Francois Bozizé and seized power. Their horrific abuses prompted creation of largely Christian militias, the Anti-Balaka, and led to increasingly intercommunal violence. Since then, sectarian attacks by each group against the other and against innocent civilians have devastated the country. An estimated 2,600 Central Africans have died, and nearly 1 million of the nation's 4.5 million citizens have been displaced, many fleeing into neighboring countries. The United States strongly endorses the conclusions of the sixth meeting of the International Contact Group on the Central African Republic, held November 11th. The group reiterates the international community's strong support for the important work that has been done by Transitional President Catherine Samba-Panza and her team to advance a peaceful, inclusive, democratic political transition in the CAR and to govern in the interests of all Central Africans. It again reaffirms the universal stand against impunity and for access to justice and accountability for violations of international humanitarian law. The group's conclusions outline a broad consensus on the way forward towards a peaceful, prosperous, tolerant, and democratic future, starting with an intensive effort of the CAR government in tandem with its international partners to prepare for an inclusive national dialogue in the next few months. It is imperative that CAR authorities ensure that this dialogue includes a wide spectrum of voices and viewpoints. The government must also continue its outreach to armed groups and begin national outreach to the provinces at the grassroots level by December 1st. The United States urges the CAR government to take all necessary steps to expedite the organization of free, fair, credible, and inclusive elections when feasible, and takes note of the contact group's request that the transition period be extended by 6 months. CAR's people and leaders continue to face the incredible challenges, but have demonstrated their resiliency and determination to move toward a better future. The United States remains a committed partner in helping the CAR in this endeavor.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.